listening to Kent Biz Connect, the show that connects businesses in Kent to do business. Tweet us live at Kent_biz.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, on this, I was going to say, sunny Monday afternoon, but it's gone a bit cloudy, but it's still nice and warm, which is nice. Welcome to the bi-weekly Kent Biz Connect radio show with myself, Martin White.
And me, Brian Wakefield.
Brian, great to be back in the studio after a couple of weeks' recess.
Yeah, you've had a little break, Martin, haven't you?
It's amazing what you can do, isn't it, in the space between two shows. So, yeah, it's been wonderful, thank you. And nice to come back to some warm weather this weekend, which was
fabulous. So where did you go?
Fabulous. I was down in France, enjoying the kind of the rural life down in France.
Enjoying cheese and wine, any chance?
Enjoying all of that, yeah, and just generally kicking back and having a nice time. But we're back in the studio today. We've got some fabulous guests with us. Why don't you introduce yourselves? Chris, can I start with you, please?
Hi, Chris Broom, Head of Business Development down at Discovery Park.
Welcome to the show, Chris. And Scarlett?
Hi, I'm Scarlett, Conference and Events Manager for Discovery Park.
And Kim.
And I'm Kim, and I'm from Victor Safety.
Brilliant. Well, welcome to the studio, guys. Thank you so much for coming over to Ashford today. We are in the fabulous offices of Kent Space, who are our hosts here for the studio. But, Brian, what we like to do, I think, is kind of kick the show off with a bit of business news, don't we? And if you guys would like to kind of contribute at some point as we run through
all
that.
All opinions welcome.
Exactly. Please do. So what have you got for us this week, Brian? What's new?
Yeah, three things, in fact, caught my eye. So I'll let you choose which ones you'd like to expand on. The infamous Paramount Park up at kind of Greenhithe, Swanscombe, which is kind of advertised as being the next. It's this place that's going to put Kent on the map, really. It's similar scale to Euro Disney in Paris, and there's all manner of offices, shops and buildings going on there.
Because there's a Garden City going in there as well, isn't there?
Ebbsfleet Garden City. Mm. I know Ebbsfleet and I can't imagine it as a Garden City, but and that's not just in football terms
You mean it should be, Ebbsfleet Concrete Jungle?
There's a lot of chalk there. There certainly is a lot of chalk, but there lies the opportunity, I think. A little bit like Bluewater. Everyone knows Bluewater, and that, of course, is what that was. That was just huge, disused chalk pits, really. But this thing has been going on for a while. But there was a statement just recently that one of the guys from London Resort Company that are behind it is claiming that there's more work being done in the last 6 months than there's been in the last 5 or 6 years. Mm. And it's really beginning to kind of crack on.
Right. Even though they haven't turned a bulldozer wheel yet.
I've done nothing. No, yeah. No.
On that level.
The talk is speeding up, yeah. I think, and maybe plans are clearer. But interestingly, Hollywood Paramount, which were one of the original kind of sponsors, founders, developers, if you like, pulled out after a while, and that's one of the reasons that everything just died a death. But now apparently they're back in, they've re-signed, they're back in and involved. People like Radisson Blue are going to be involved. And I mean, it was supposed to have been completed in 2019. So that's where we are now, and there's no chance of that. So I don't know how long this is going to take. It could be 5 to 10 years.
Chris is smiling away there in the background.
As well he may. I don't blame him.
So, Chris, as someone that used to work for Locating Kent, you must know some of the kind of the story and history behind all of this, I guess, do you? Or?
I do. And it's,
how does it sound to you, Chris?
Well, the project's been on, off. And, I mean, clearly it's a big opportunity for Kent, but I have some sympathy with some of the businesses that have been waiting, and hopefully this will give them some certainty whether the project goes ahead or not.
Yeah, I guess it's with. I mean, you guys know yourselves, Scarlett and Chris, that I guess a lot of this is down to financing and money at the end of the day, isn't it? And unless the financing and the money is in place, these projects just kind of sit on the drawing board, don't they? I mean, that's the reality.
Hugely complex projects, I think, probably on just on the transport and assessments alone. It's not in a a lot of traffic in that area. So
so you've got to have central government involved. And as we all know, with our current experience...
They're otherwise engaged.
As soon as you get central government involved, things can sort of stand still for
actually,
some time.
Boris likes a push bike, does he not?
So. Yeah, well, Boris Island, that was another sort of big infrastructure idea, wasn't it? We won't get into that, but... It sounds all very positive, though.
Yeah, it's something up in that part of Kent, which, of course, will affect the whole of Kent. I mean, I can remember when they built and opened Bluewater, and I was a member of one of the kind of advanced party of guests that went before it opened up and saw behind the scenes. It was fascinating, really, really interesting. However, the downside of it was that the pressure on the A2 and the M2 and the M25 was just, it would quite often come to a standstill, and in December don't go anywhere near there basically because it just everything gridlocks. So
well, of course that's another interesting project that's kind of on the cards, isn't it? We've got the Thames, the second sort of Thames crossing, haven't we? That's supposed to be going ahead. I don't know, Christy.
What's happened to that?
Do you know what the latest on that is?
I think it's all gone quiet. Yes.
The Lower Thames Crossing, I think it was known as.
Final consultation.
But that's a 10-year infrastructure project to build that alone, isn't it? So that's not going to help this new resort, is it, in terms of easing the traffic flow there. We've got Manston, I mean, where we live, and obviously on Discovery Park's kind of doorstep, we've got Manston Airport, which is going to be reopening, I think, after they've solved the lorry parking crisis, because it's just a... I don't know if you when you drive past Manston today, it's just a series of cones.
Alan Partridge would love that.
Which is sort of designated lorry parking, isn't it, I think, at the moment. And that's, I think there's a contract until, is it the end of next year or something?
It's 2021.
With the Department of Transport.
So. The airport's open.
But I mean, in theory, people will be able to fly in to Manston. You know, if EasyJet, for example, or somebody like that, and this is where I think it kind of always missed a trick, you know, they needed a sort of serious commercial operator to kind of to take the opportunity by the throat, as it were. But, I mean, in theory, people would be able to fly in for a weekend at London Paramount, wouldn't they?
They've just got to do that little bit in between. Sit on the M2 for 5 hours or something, but no, there's the train, of course, isn't
exactly.
there? Because it's with Ebbsfleet from Ashford and beyond. So
Manston Parkway
kind of
was kind of being muted and still is, I think, you know, having a dedicated station for Manston. So, I mean, if all of this came together, it would actually be incredibly exciting, wouldn't it, I think?
It'd be brilliant for the local economy and that kind of stuff. It's going to help a lot of businesses, which is good. But it's a chuckle when you said about the Thames Crossing and if that's going to get going. Of course, it wouldn't surprise me if they decided to press ahead with that and Paramount Park at exactly the same time. So we get double disruption because we like that, don't we? Yeah. We like the whole, we've spoken before about the M20 and the M2 being basically shut at the same time. So Kent's two motorways, you know, let's bring the whole thing to a standstill if we can, not just half the county. So there might be an element of that. That'll be interesting, I think, kind of keep on top of that.
Yeah. Before we even get into what Brexit may or may not look like in terms of trade and lorries and everything else. So, but anyway, it sounds very positive. And I guess, Chris, you would know better than anybody else, any money coming into the county on an inward investment level is got to be a good thing, hasn't it? So,
it's a huge, huge project. And clearly that would give enormous opportunities for construction companies and all the other services, professional services alike, mention tourism and the hospitality sector.
Right. So, Brian, you are now our roving reporter.
Yes, exactly.
And we expect...
If I sneak up on everybody from behind, that's why. It's
absolutely.
Purely for research.
We expect regular updates over the coming months and hopefully not years.
well, quite, yeah. I was... they had an event, actually, actually last week at Ebbsfleet Football Ground with Wilkins Kennedy and Waitman's, people like that involved. Well, and I did get an invitation to it for some strange reason, but I just couldn't go. I forget where else I was, but I had to decline. So, there was that.
What else have you got for us? What else is kind of hot and exciting?
The underlying thing were one of these is that the Heritage Fund for Historic England.
Yes.
So are we all aware of that and what it does? No,
neither
was I
number,
until I read it.
Because it's a fairly modest number, isn't it? What was the headline number?
Well, it is. Basically what it does, it's a fund, Historic England. There was 200 entries, so it's basically where towns can put in for a slice of the action to kind of refurbish their towns and areas. Mm. And 200 entries, 68 or 69 have actually been awarded. It's a £95 million fund.
Right.
So I guess if you split it, it's a million.
Just over a million each.
A million and a half each or whatever. Mm. The good news is that two Kent towns, one is Ramsgate and one is Chatham. Mm. So the home of Buckmore Park, which we'll actually come on to later. But those two have been awarded, and it's basically, specifically I should say, to spruce up the high street. And there's pictures of the high streets and stuff like that, and there's some lovely buildings in the high street, some of the old kind of NatWest buildings. I think there's one in Ramsgate that kind of aren't really being used and stuff like that. So they're going to do stuff, and I guess for me, before I hand over to you guys, the intelligentsia is, for me at least, it acknowledges the fact that that high streets are important, and people, they're a focal point for lots of people, socially, community wise, and that they are going to put some time and effort into kind of jazzing them up a little bit, really. So guys, what's your take on that? Looking forward to having your high streets jazzed up? And
I think it's a good thing, because you need more independent businesses there. You don't want your big name. You do want your big names, because they bring the crowds in, but then to give smaller businesses like your independent coffee shops and restaurants and places like that. Yeah. At the moment, you walk down and every other shop's either a barber shop or a nail bar or a charity shop.
Yeah.
Yes.
You want more diversity and bring people in. I've met people that I've spoken to and said, I've been in Ashford for 5 years, never been in the high street, never been into town, because they live on the outskirts and they have no need.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. I mean, Ramsgate is right on our doorstep, Scarlett and Chris and me. Yeah. So, well, I don't know, where do you, are you sort of Dover side, Chris, or do you...
Outskirts of Dover.
Oh, are you? Okay, so you're slightly the other way. What about you, Scarlett? Are you more Ramsgate?
I'm Canterbury.
Oh, you're Canterbury.
Oh, well, they've got 1,000 high streets in Canterbury. But, does Dover have a high street, Chris, or...?
I'm ashamed to say I don't frequent it too often, but I think they need to just find their identity without town shopping, need to drive footfall.
Yes.
I think Ashford's probably a good example of that, with the new brewery that's open, the cinema, and the eateries that are coming. So hopefully Dover can catch up.
Because you're fast becoming a mini town yourselves, aren't you? I mean, we're going to talk in more detail later, but you know, the way that you're looking at your site is a kind of a blank sheet of paper in terms of, you know, residential development, property development, you know, hotels coming onto the site potentially. So, you know, in many ways, you're kind of going down that road as well, aren't you? As a sort of community in your own right.
I think we're looking at the service provision that we need for our tenants and our community on site. So hotels just been given planning permission. The work should start on a 75-bed travel lodge soon.
Mm-hmm.
There's planning permission in for a Euro garages with a drive-through coffee shop.
Right.
And then we have planning or outline consent for about 500 homes.
Incredible. Yeah. Wow.
Good mix,
yeah,
I think.
Fantastic, yeah. But coming back to this money, Brian, where do you think they're going to spend it? I mean, it's not a lot. I mean, £1 million doesn't go a long way these days, is it?
It really doesn't, especially in terms of building projects and things like that. So I don't know. I guess you're going to get the odd water feature here and there and things like that. Pedestrianiser stuff. You know, that will do it, won't it? Put a water feature in there. That will bring them flooding back. See what I did there? There was a bit of a link in itself, wasn't it? But it's difficult to say. And I think they'll have the same dilemma, is that it's a million and a half and it's nice, but there's lots and lots of choices, lots of things to spend it on. What are we going to spend it on?
It's a tough one, isn't it? I mean, we'd have to look at the detail of their application, I guess, to understand where they envisaged, because obviously each application was assessed on its merits, as it were, and I guess we'd have to look into a bit more detail as to where specifically they envisaged spending the money. I mean, some places, I mean, in Dover, you mentioned Dover, Chris, you've got rid of that awful hotel that used to be such an eyesore on the dual carriageway there. And was it the County Hotel or something that got demolished a couple of years ago?
Yeah, the County Hotel.
And that's helped, I think, immeasurably, because it was just such a horrible building to drive past, and sort of visually and aesthetically, things like that, I think, can probably help a lot, you know. I'm thinking about Ramsgate, you know, there's a really ugly multi-storey car park, you know, just off the high street. And some of the buildings are very kind of, you know, we went through this kind of phase in the 50s of just building horrible concrete buildings. And, you know, there's a few of those that maybe could just be spruced up, or maybe, you know, have some kind of hanging garden put on the front of them, just to kind of make the whole place feel a bit more kind of aspirational. And
well, it's a good point, actually, because I think a few programmes ago we mentioned Folkestone and all the stuff that's gone on there. And I went at some point earlier in the year and hadn't been for a year, 18 months. Couldn't believe the difference, because they've redone the pier with the old harbour. Railway there, the harbour, and there's lots of kind of Prosecco bars and there's jazz bands going on. And it was really, really good. It was phenomenal. Lots of car parking. But kind of all around that, in the centre of that, is that whacking great big hotel. Is it the Grand Bursting or something like that? That massive great big hotel right on the front, on the corner.
Yeah.
And
is it the Grand?
I think is it?
Yeah.
Now, back in the 60s and 70s, that would have been a phenomenal place, I'm sure. Mm. But it still does look like it's in the 60s and 70s. I'm sure it hasn't been painted since then. And I just think, please give it a lick of paint, because it's an eyesore now.
So simple things like that is maybe where because the money won't go far. So, you know, concentrate on some of those.
It kind
obvious
of undoes all the good work that's around it, really. And you just sort of like a magnet, you just get homing back thinking, oh, look at that paint and plaster coming off of there.
But I mean, that's the one thing I think that, you know, places like Dover, Ramsgate, Folkestone, Margate have all got in common. They have all got these fabulous natural harbours. And businesses kind of springing off around that, you know, in terms of restaurants and cafes and that kind of culture and art and, you know, and all of those kind of things. And I think they've all got that in common. And I think they are lovely places to go and spend time. I mean, Dover, you know, the old harbour bit of Dover, you know, obviously well away from the ferries. It's a lovely area, and there's a market there and a super beach, and it's actually quite a nice place to go and spend an afternoon on the seafront there. So I think they have got a lot going for them, but they just need to, you know, clearly address some of the obvious kind of aesthetic problems on the high street per se, and I'm sure people would spend money. So
Yeah, they would.
But it's
all good, positive stuff, I think. It really is. Just a quick one that I'll slide in, and this, of course, is the biggest news of the day, is that just this morning I became a granddad for the second time. So, yes, got a grandson now. Thank you very much. £7.12.
Oh, nice healthy
weight. Yes, indeed. Yeah. So, obviously, haven't seen him yet or anything like that. Down in Pembury with his mum, Michelle, and we might end up looking after his sister, Imogen, later, I think. So, don't ask me the names. Got to be something ending in IN. Probably won't be Brian or Martin, but
why not?
I don't know. What do people call children these days? Brooklyn or Tarquin or something like that.
Tarquin.
I don't know. I don't want to put ideas into Michelle and Peter's heads, and hopefully it won't be one of those. But
well,
but
congratulations.
Show me age. Yeah, got a full set now, one of each.
So, fabulous.
That's good. Have we got time for any more news?
Have we got one other thing? Did you have on there, or was something about fruit? Was it or something?
Fruit and veg. Yeah, I'm opening up fruit and veg.
Fruit and veg.
That's where it's at.
Yeah.
Just to get people's views on and something. It's a kind of little piece of news, I guess, is that caught my eye on trends in Herne Bay, a bit more East Kent. So there's the Wall Street News and Video, which is basically a convenience store. The current owners took it over 14 years ago. I think it was her parents opened back in the 80s as a film rental store. Does anybody remember that? When people used to go and rent videos?
Not a Blockbuster, but a small independent.
Along those lines. Mm. And, of course, that doesn't happen anymore, does it? Because people don't do that. But they said that they're really, really struggling against the likes of got a Tesco and an Aldi up the road, so price-wise, etc. So it's going to have a third change of business, really, in kind of 30, 40 years, and it's going to become a micro-pub. So that caught my eye, the fact that we've gone from videos to kind of convenience stores and then on to this, so the changing face of business and how times change. But it's going to be the fifth micro pub in Herne Bay. And that seems a lot of micro pubs in a place like Herne Bay. Mm. I assume they're doing well. Mm. And yet the pub business, per se, is really, really struggling.
The Tide Estate business.
How many are they? Pubs are closing down every week. Mm. People are saying, you know, since the smoking ban, since food things, and one or two others, we're losing pubs hand over fist. Mm. Yet micro pubs seem to be exploding. Why is that? Yeah. Can I throw that open to the guest to answer that?
Well, Chris, you're
you look like a pub man, was you going to say?
You're our resident real ale drinker. Tell us, what's your kind of, what's the attraction? Do you think of micro pubs versus a pub?
I think people just want locally produced a choice rather than from the big name breweries.
Right,
say.
That's a good one. Yeah, why not?
Different atmosphere and stuff like that, is there or not?
I think you tend to find it's more, you get more of the local vibe because there's a couple in Ashford and I'm a real ale drinker as well.
Right.
And it's that you can go in and you don't know what you're going to get to drink because it changes every week. Mm. But also you get recommendations from people and it's you can walk in there. Mm-hmm. And I've walked into our local one on my own and not been, as a woman, you know, afraid to walk in. Where sometimes in some of the bigger, you know, high street things, you kind of go, you walk in, everyone looks at you.
Yes.
But on the micro pubs, you tend to get that more family-friendly appeal.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they're independently owned, aren't they, obviously? And they tend to have little things like pork pie segments on the bar, which I love. There's one I go to in Margate, and they always has a little, on a Sunday, and have little bits of pork pie or a scotch egg or something, and you can just help yourself. Whereas a Wetherspoons or a big national chain, they would, you know, that, well, it's not in the budget, we haven't got the margin for that.
We went into one on a Sunday once, and they had like roast potatoes, and the smell of the roast potatoes.
Yeah,
but nobody went overboard and was greedy. Everybody just,
but they'd want you to, because there's a lot of salt on there, and of course it makes you drink a lot more, doesn't it? That's the old cynic. Well, that was the thinking behind it, wasn't it? And peanuts on the bar and stuff like that.
But I think it's great. I mean, I think it's experience, isn't it? You know, it's just a, it's just a nicer experience, I think, you know, it just shows that, you know, there's clearly a market out there for people that want to go somewhere and have a drink. And what the pubs have got to do is kind of move with the, you know, the change, if you like, and adapt. I mean, I was, you know, going back to France, I was in a tiny little village that I know quite well down there. I've been going to for 30 years, called Cotignac, last week. And they had a micro pub that had just opened up. And going back to kind of why...
Did they have snails on the bar and things?
They
like
didn't.
That?
They might do at some point in the future. They didn't even have
salted snails.
They were doing a very French thing, you know, charcuterie, you know, so a bit of salami and some bread and stuff, which was all very nice. But they were, you know, they were brewing IPA and they weren't brewing bitter. They tend to kind of they've only just opened up, but they are going to be brewing bitter in the autumn and winter. And of course, that then led me on to, well, where are you going to get your hops from? You know, because you can't grow hops in the south of France. You know, it's too hot and there's no rain. And in fact, that's why a lot of the wine producers are really struggling with their yields this year again, because whilst they've got this intense sun and so the sugar content is obviously there all the time, they're not getting the rain, which means the grapes aren't growing as big as they need to in order to get the yield in terms of volume.
Not that he knows anything about wine. You can see that.
But so I said to him, look, you know, I live in Kent. We've got Britain's oldest brewer just up the road in Faversham, Shepherd Neame. Would you like me to put you in touch with them to see if they could supply you some hops for your, you know, for your pub? And then again, that, you know, it just kind of, that's why Brexit and kind of putting barriers to trade just doesn't make sense.
No.
Because, you know, we live in a global economy now where why shouldn't they source their hops from, you know, from the hop farms of Kent, for example, for their microbrewery down in the south of France?
I think now you've divulged that, Martin. If we have a referendum tomorrow, everyone will vote Remain, won't they, on the basis of that, if they know they're not going to get any beer and stuff?
Yeah, well, certainly not. Nobody's going to be voting for trade restrictions, let's put it that way. But while we're on the subject of France, we've actually had a request for a shout-out.
Good Lord.
From Izzy and Cliff at Clifford Den Design, who are a design studio based down near Antibes, and they do branding, they do super yachts, they do cruise ships, they do product design, they do interior design and building design as well. And they've asked us to give them a shout out on the radio today. So,
oh, lovely.
Guys, thank you very much for getting in touch with us.
And welcome to our listeners in Antibes.
Welcome to our growing international listenership, now including the south of France, where it is very sunny
the Kemp
today.
Is connect, fickled finger of fate is pointing far and wide.
Right. Brian, that was fantastic. Thank you for that.
Oh, you're very welcome.
News roundup, and thank you for your various contributions there. What I think we're going to do now is move on to our kind of cheesy tunage section, which will serve as a kind of an introductory taster for our first guest. So I'm going to leave you in the capable hands of some tunage. Well, welcome back to the show. Brian, you are our resident music expert.
Yes, I am. And
enlighten us.
Yeah, well, that had me a little bit stumped for a while. But I think it was, yeah, I remember it. She Blinded Me with Science, Thomas Dolby.
Thomas Dolby, well done.
He was never up there with the Spice Girls and Elton John, was he?
Well, but, I quite like that song. It's one of my kind of favourites.
What year is that from?
Oh, it must be 80s.
85, I was going to say.
Late 80s, yeah. But
The link is science, is it?
Well,
not?
The link is always tenuous, and it's about as close as we could get to our fabulous first guests on the show today. So we have Scarlett Atkins.
Hello.
And we have Chris Broom.
Hello.
From our friends at Discovery Park in Sandwich. So welcome to the show, guys.
So what's the science link then? Enlighten me from Northwest Kent.
I guess the science link is originally Discovery Park was Pfizer UK headquarters, I guess, wasn't it?
Europe, I think.
European headquarters.
Oh, I was going to ask that.
Okay.
Okay.
And, hence the connection with science, I guess. But it's Chris is now going to tell us. It's evolved a little bit since then. So tell us, Chris, what is Discovery Park today?
Well, I think most people still know it as the former Pfizer site. But actually, Pfizer have still got a very large presence on site, which a lot of people seem to forget or don't know.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
But it's grown from really being a single site Pfizer into a multi-tenanted science and business facility as it is today. So it's very much a campus environment with a multitude of business. Science at its core is really our focus. But as we mentioned earlier, we're looking, we've got planning permission now for a travel lodge. We've got retail. We're looking at other development opportunities. We've got manufacturing businesses on site, from pharmaceutical manufacturing all the way through to more sort of composite resin manufacturing. We've got our own energy provision on site in form of biomass.
Yes, of course. You've got a huge biomass plant that burns wood.
several hundred tons, I think.
Yes, yeah. And every time I go past one of those lorries on the M2 or the Thanetway, wherever it is, I'm thinking, crikey, one of those logs would last my wood burner, my modest little wood burner in my lounge all year. So how does that work exactly? I mean, where does that wood come from?
I think it's sourced from all over the UK. I think they may have some sort of top-up from Europe maybe and from Canada, but some of it's from ash dieback as well.
Right. So unlike the Amazon rainforest where wood is just kind of precious wood is being burnt, this is wood that's being grown to feed biomass
managed woodland.
Managed. Fantastic. Good. So it really is quite a varied, and it's very much a business park rather than an industrial estate. I think that's the key thing as well, isn't it?
I guess it's like a university campus, but for science and general business. But science is very much at our core. We've got 160 companies, 3,500 people on site.
Wow.
And a multitude of businesses, ranging from drug development to recruitment.
Yes, absolutely. And everything in between, I know, yeah. And Pfizer's quite an interesting example, isn't it? Because having sort of ripped up the manual and said, right, we're off, they then didn't quite go, and now they're investing more money, aren't they? So is it sort of £10 million investment they're about to make on the site? What's the kind of story behind that at the moment?
So Pfizer are actually growing. They've made significant investment in the last 18 months. I think it's more $36 million in the last 18 months. So it's great news that they're growing, recruiting as well. So it's fabulous news for us and for them, obviously. But in addition to Pfizer, we've got probably another 30 or 40 science businesses on site.
Right.
And then a number of general businesses as well.
And they're all feeding off, ultimately, that kind of community feel that you've managed to create. Because if a business wants to relocate somewhere, a business that's in a science field or a medical field, for example, what better place for them to kind of go than Discovery Park and kind of network and feed off all these other businesses that are in the same space, I guess.
Definitely. So we've got a number of businesses that work together on site. It's very much a community feel, so they trade together. A lot of open innovation, even with Pfizer now, it's a lot more open. Scientists now openly talking about what they do, what they're working on. Universities on site as well, so looking to sort of involve their students, their PhD students in some of the science. So it's definitely open innovation, collaborations, definitely really what we're
the name of the game, yeah. But it's not just science, is it? And I mean, it is much broader than that, because you offer office space from sort of very small micro co-working space up to individual offices, up to, as you say, you could rehome a multinational if you needed to, I guess, on site. It's that big. But going back to these kind of non-science-based businesses, as you said, it's everything from recruitment to, promotional materials. It really is everything. I mean, the park offers something for all businesses, ultimately, that need a home, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we've got startup space from sort of £99 a month. You have digital marketing businesses, IT businesses, some retail businesses, all the way through to offices for recruitment businesses, accountants, IT, digital media.
Right.
There's an awful lot of businesses across. There's probably most of the things that you need in day-to-day business you can source invariably on site.
Yeah. So again, all these businesses, in the same way that science firms are all kind of feeding off each other and collaborating and working together, which is kind of a very, very healthy environment to have, I guess, if you're looking to do business and grow your business. You know, you want to move somewhere where you've almost kind of got a ready-made business on site, haven't you? I think that's the key thing. If I was looking to put my business somewhere, you know, I'd want to put it somewhere physically where I knew I would actually win business. And that must be a sort of a key selling point for you and a key attraction, I guess.
Definitely. I think a number of our businesses have been with us since 2012 when the site was sold by Pfizer to the previous owners. So a number have grown exponentially on site and taken a number of different offices. So it's great to see them doing well and, in turn, hopefully, we do well as well.
Yeah, okay.
So it's fascinating, isn't it? Because, okay, I'm far from an expert being up at the other end of Kent, but the one thing I kind of saw on it was that the news broke, and it was on the national news and everything, that Pfizer were going to be kind of exiting it and closing it down, and this site was going to be derelict. They were moving out, all these jobs were going, and it was just going to be left to rack and ruin, basically, but that's clearly not the case. Which is...
the government stepped in, I think, as well, didn't they, Chris? And you were probably at locating...
Is that how the story unfolded?
So I think government stepped in with a package of funding, essentially, for businesses that were looking to relocate or expand. So that definitely helped, and Kent County Council played a big role, along with central government, in that.
Because you have enterprise zone status, don't you? Which I think comes with a number of benefits along those lines, doesn't it?
It does, albeit that the business rate element of that ran out last year, I believe. Mm. So that was the really main thrux of the financial benefit for companies. So they would get business rate relief up to 55,000 per annum.
Mm-hmm.
That's now not the case. But, technically we still do have enterprise zone status. Mm. And I think we're still one of the most successful enterprise zones that the 26 that were formed.
Yeah, so that comes with things like super fast broadband and all that kind of infrastructure stuff that's really important for businesses as well, doesn't it? So
yeah, put the fibre on site, it's almost limitless in terms of our connections. So we are blessed with a world-class infrastructure and asset, if you like.
Yeah, I want to bring Scarlett in now. Because you're not just about office space and technology and science and businesses kind of collaborating and working together. You're also a bona fide conference space, meeting space in your own right as well, aren't you? And in fact, you have
the event centre at Discovery Park. So it's very popular to obviously tenants on site and also people off site. So we're open to the public. We have lots of events that talk about, obviously, what Chris was just saying, science-based education. But we also do just general events, a lot of networking events. So not only do we have the community networking events on site, but we also have outside networking events. So we are open to the public.
Right, so you really are open for business. Yeah.
Yes, we are.
So in terms of events and meetings and conferences and things like that, I mean, what sort of size of event, what's your kind of your smallest and what's your largest that you kind of cater for down on site?
So given the site size, you can imagine we've got quite a lot of space. So we have altogether 16 conference suites, and we can have obviously the interview stars of one-on-one, but our maximum kind of goes up to 800 to 1,000 in reception style. So, it's quite big.
And what about catering?
We have catering on site, and we can provide all of the catering for all of the events. So if you're booking an event on site, we basically event manage it for you. So you wouldn't have to worry about sorting anything out yourself. We'll be able to have a meeting with you, find out what it is you want to achieve from the event or the conference, and just run it for you, really.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, organizing, catering, everything.
So, all on site, so you can do from sort of full cooked English breakfast right the way through to brunches, lunches and dinners, I guess.
And banquet style,
okay.
What time do you start in the mornings? Brian runs a network.
I'm thinking ahead here.
It starts at
7 o'clock in the morning. So are you open for business
full English
that early?
At 7 a.m. in the morning. Yeah, that's not a problem for us.
Superb.
Oh, okay. All right, that's good to know, isn't it?
Isn't it?
And we've got a large community on site as well, so we can help with networking events.
Yeah.
Mm. Brilliant. Might be able to spring your neck of the woods back into life here, Whitey.
Well, there we go. But you've also got outside space as well, which I think is a really nice addition.
We do, yes.
So what sort of outside areas have you got?
So obviously we have our Gateway Courtyard, which is a lovely area to have outside barbecues if you're having a corporate event. We have quite a lot of people that tend to hire it privately for their end of year event or even a summer barbecue event as well. We also have just obviously large field area, so you can have a huge marquee on site. You can do almost your own bespoke event if you wanted to. if there's a particular logo that you wanted, we can change everything so it all matches the corporate style.
Mm. And you've, I mean, give us some examples of some of the sort of variety of stuff that you've done down there recently, because I know you've played host to film crews and so are you able to tell us about is that all hush hush?
Well, we had a lot of filming companies over the years anyway, which obviously we had the tunnel filmed at Discovery Park, which everyone will probably know.
Mm-hmm.
We had Baptiste, which was filmed. So we're a very popular site for the filming industry. And we had a recent one that was obviously quite large scale. And we had Brad Pitt, obviously.
Brad Pitt?
Well, that was back in the day. So,
wow.
Yeah.
As opposed to Chalk Pitt, like we get at Ebbsfleet.
Yes, he had World War
II. That's his brother.
So we had some A-list stars down at Discovery Park.
Wow.
Mm.
So tell me, how does it work? Because if you go to, I don't know, let's say you go to a hotel and you say, I want to run a conference or I want to run a charity event or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is it done on a kind of a day delegate rate? How do you actually price something like that? Do I need to come to you with a budget or do you have a kind of flat rate that you work from? Or?
So obviously we have an hourly rate, a day delegate rate. We also would kind of find out what it is you want to do.
Right.
So we kind of make sure that we make sure it works for you.
Mm-hmm.
And we would tailor make the package that would suit your budget. So even if you had quite a small budget, we could work with that, or obviously a higher budget, and we can make sure that we filter everything in for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because hotels tend to sort of lead on, I don't know, £35 per person, and that would include maybe tea and coffee all day long, you know, the room itself, and maybe a kind of a bacon roll or something to start the things off. Is that...
Yeah, so we have a day delegate rate, which includes obviously all your room hire, your AV equipment, all of your catering, but then some people might just say, we just want to have tea and coffee throughout the day. And we also have creative kitchen on site and also a canteen area as well. So some people prefer just to break out of the meeting room for a bit of time.
Oh, and they can go and,
go and sort themselves out for lunch. And also, if they wanted to, they could have a tour of the office space as well. It's quite popular.
So those are tenant catering businesses that you have on site as well, I guess. Are those creative kitchen? Is that a...
That's us.
Oh, that's actually you. Oh, yes. I didn't know that. I'm sorry. I'd assume that was
a... No, we do all of our own catering. Yeah.
And the coffee shop that's sort of near, that's you guys as well.
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's fabulous. Right. So it really is in-house.
So it's very easy to get catering in-house.
Yeah. Superb. Good. Chris, I want to come back to you a little bit now and talk about the kind of the future and where... Discovery Park is kind of going, because we touched on the in the first part of the show on some of the kind of developments and projects, big kind of projects that are going on the site. So what's kind of new and exciting that we need to be kind of looking out for and kind of upcoming, if you can tell us?
we're lucky in that we've got a very large site with a lot of development opportunities. Some of our focus is really on bringing back some of the laboratory areas. And attracting those science-based businesses to site. We've also got some specialist manufacturing facilities, clean room facilities, which there's a lot of interest at the moment for sterile manufacture. So
that's all tied in with GLP and good GLP, laboratory practice and all that kind of stuff.
All the science talk. So, there's a lot of interest in that space at the moment, so we're looking to capitalise on that. As much as the other opportunities, which are sort of retail, the hotel, and the residential plans, which possibly will kick off next year.
So retail-wise, when we've just been talking about high streets, what are we talking about in a kind of retail context? What's the kind of the vision there in terms of, you know, outlets and
nothing,
shops?
Nothing that's really going to impact too heavily on the high street. I think it's more complementary to the hotel development and also the garage. So drive-through retail, coffee shop, really providing another area for our tenants on site, and also the people that live on the site, giving them a different offer. So it becomes much more a campus environment,
not
just
business.
Because you are
very much a sort of gated community, aren't you? I mean, there is a perimeter fence around Discovery Park. You're not open to the public per se, are you? It's not, it doesn't really work like that.
For the event centre, I would say we're very public.
But I couldn't drive in, for example, with the new coffee shop. I couldn't drive in at midnight and go and buy a...
No, you could.
Oh, I could. I wouldn't have to park and then...
No.
Oh, okay,
it
right.
It would be accessible from the same as the hotel would be. So it's accessible from on the main roundabout as you're coming from Dover.
So 24-7.
Very visible. Right. I don't know if it would be 24-7.
Yeah. But, so that is quite a fundamental change, isn't it, for you guys? Because at the moment... You know, if you visit Discovery Park, you know, as a tenant, you park in one of the tenant car parks, or as a visitor, you go, you park in the visitor centre car park, and then you walk in. Whereas moving forwards, you know, with the hotel and the car, you'll be able to just access that directly from the road, I guess.
Yeah, and independently of having to come onto site, essentially.
Yes.
I mean, the site is, obviously the fences that you mentioned are a legacy from Pfizer days. The site is secure. We have 24/7 security.
Yes.
But it's not as militant in terms of the security as it was in controlled, say, as in Pfizer days. So it is more, the park is more open. We look to promote open innovation, collaboration.
Right.
Tenants are free to walk around the site within reason.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they have access cards that prevent unauthorized access outside of common areas and their demise.
Mm-hmm.
But we want people to move freely and talk and open and collaborate because that's how really business, and we found that's where businesses want to be successful.
Yes. I was wondering about that because the way that Martin described it, I was kind of picturing Stalag Luft or something. and it didn't sound completely welcoming. So obviously I've never been, I will put that right, but I've not been. So I was kind of thinking, what's the difference between, I can picture an industrial estate, but you're not that. What would you say to the uninitiated like me that have never seen it? What are the kind of major differences then?
It's more, I would say it's more like a university campus, that you drive onto site, you park, you walk to where you need to be, and you've got access to the event space, the catering facilities, the common areas. Obviously, you do need to report to reception if you're a visitor. And then you're signposted as to where you need to be, or you're greeted by the company that you're visiting. But it's certainly not locked down at all. We don't promote that at all. It's very much open. People can walk around the site.
So you don't just kind of drive on and then drive to the unit that you want. You know where your client is or whatever, drive there, park there, go in and leave again. It's more of a centralised.
The site's vast, so there's a number of car parking areas. And typically you're probably a 2-minute walk away from the main areas of employment, the offices and the lab space.
Oh, okay.
Well, and as you said, with the hotel and, you know, the coffee shop and things moving forward, people will need to be able to access that immediately anyway, won't they? So that's going to fundamentally change it again, I think, isn't it? And
for sure. I mean, a number of our tenants have got global connections, and hotel accommodation is only going to help them in terms of visitors that are coming over to see their facilities. And it adds also for Scarlett's events and conferencing. It means that we can target other events
because they've got somewhere to stay.
You can stay on site and then walk over to your conference the next day. So,
what would be the kind of suggested mode of transport, if you like, for kind of European visitors if they're coming over? What would be the best way to get there, to approach it? And
we've got two coming tomorrow, actually, so I believe they're, one set are flying in and then travelling down by car
from
Stansted.
Okay.
And then another, I believe, are driving from the London area. We had people on site last week that took the train to Sandwich, and hopefully if the new Parkway station gets built, then that means we'll be under an hour.
Yeah.
And of course, if Manston comes to fruition and passenger services, then we're only 5 minutes' drive from Manston. So it's all good news for us.
Oh, yeah, Parkway's the one we spoke about, isn't it?
Well,
extending the platforms because of everything.
No, that's actually at Sandwich.
Is it?
So the platform extension is at Sandwich around the open.
We said Sandwich, didn't we?
But Parkway would be a new station at Manston to service the airport.
Okay, so then they would get to you how from there? Kind of a short taxi ride,
so
really?
So that would need a shuttle ride by taxi or by bus.
Okay.
It's about a 5-minute drive from the proposed location.
Now, bearing in mind we've got the Open Championship coming to Sandwich next year, and the hotel plans, what does the time frame kind of fit with that? Is that the objective, or...?
I think they would like it to be. I mean, they're on site at the moment doing the survey work, so I guess it's just how quickly they put it up. But it's mainly modular, I believe, so it should go up.
I was amazed to learn that from you guys, that they'll literally just drive it down there almost and bolt it together, which is quite incredible, isn't it? So
it is probably a bit more complex.
Of course, of course. I'm simplifying things because I'm not a builder. But nevertheless, it could feasibly be open in time for the Open next summer. So
I'm sure they'll want it to be.
That's how quickly things can
happen. Martin will want it to be.
Well, I mean, I don't need to worry, but I'm sure some people will be interested in that, yeah. Mm. So, guys, what's the best way to get in touch with you? Scarlett, you are the event centre manager at Discovery Park. Mm-hmm. So if I'm interested in making an inquiry because I'm looking to run an event or a conference or a gala dinner even, how do I get in touch with you guys? What's the best way to do that?
So you can either just give us a call, or the best way also is email. I know that some people prefer to do that because it's quicker and you can just send it over. So you just email me direct, which is all on our website, but also it's Scarlett, so scarlett.atkins@discoveryeventscentre.com, and just send it over and we'll take your inquiry and hopefully you'll come down for a show round.
Perfect.
And we'll sort that event out for you.
Good. So you'll walk around with somebody, show them the different kind of options
all
in terms
of
space,
options. The size
pricing.
Is so different. So obviously you can just come to us, explain what you'd like to do and how you'd like it to look, and we can make sure that happens for you. And hopefully, obviously, with the hotel, that accommodation is there as well.
Perfect. And Chris, when it comes to kind of more of a kind of a chat around office space and kind of who's the best person to kind of to contact on that basis, what's the best way to inquire?
So you can contact any of the team. Renata tends to deal with mainly the office inquiries, but you can pop down to site and there'll always be someone to show you around, if you like, from 8 till 5. Or give us a call and arrange a time to view.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. And I guess that the message that I'm kind of getting and taking out from all of this is you are very much open to business outside of the kind of the business that's already on site. So don't think of you guys as a closed shop, and if you're not here, then, we can't do business with you. You very much want to attract businesses from all over Kent to come and have that conversation.
We've obviously got laboratory space, specialist manufacturing space, warehousing space. So I think a lot of people don't quite realise that there's not too much that we can't accommodate within reason on site. And of course we've got land available for development as well.
Right, okay, brilliant. So lots to think about there. Guys, for the meantime, thank you so much for coming on the show. That has been incredibly enlightening. I think what we're going to do now, Brian, if we can, is we're going to play a little bit more tunage by way of an introduction to our next guest, Kim from Invicta Safety. And again, we will let people make the link themselves.
So, yes, we will indeed.
Here we go. Well, we're back. Brian, who was that? Blast from the past.
It's a good old mate of mine, that was. That was Chris O'Dowd. And you're thinking, who? But it was. It was everyone would know him as Boy George of Culture Club. But back in the day, because he's from Eltham, where I went to school.
Okay.
And in the same school year, he went to Eltham Green. I went to Crown Woods. But, yeah, Chris O'Dowd.
Gosh.
Eltham Green.
Yes.
And I saw him live do that in 1984 as well. So that's showing me age.
I think it's fair to say you took quite different paths in life, isn't it? So. Same school, same age, but slightly different paths.
I dress a lot more outrageously than he does. Yes. So
so tell us, why have we just played that that song?
Well, that was Do You Really Want to Hurt Me?
Ah.
So Do You Really Want to Make Me Cry?
Right.
but the hurt me bit, and you can get hurt if you don't kind of adhere to your health and safety regulations properly, both physically and financially, of course. So
on that basis.
To expand on that subject, I think we ought to bring in an expert, which is Kim.
Hi. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming on. I know you haven't had far to come because your offices are actually based... over the road, is
literally
that right?
Down the road, yeah.
So you've been able to walk over here today, which is fabulous. So Invicta Safety, tell us, how long have you been going as a business now?
Probably about 8 years, seven or eight years.
Okay.
In total. We've built up a lot over the last 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
We've kind of grown dramatically.
Uh-huh.
In the early days, it was just my husband.
Right.
And then we've gradually built up client base and we've asked to do more and more stuff.
It's very much a family effort, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's yourself and Andrew,
yeah.
Who can't be with us today. He's a bit poorly at home, so we wish him well. Andrew, you're no doubt tuned in. Tell me, I'm just interested, how does the kind of dynamic work on that level when you have a sort of a husband and wife team together in business? Does it? I mean, it obviously works for you guys, but...
Yeah, I mean, everyone says, how's it working together? But we rarely spend any time together in the office.
Right.
We both go out and do different parts. Andrew spends a lot of time out on the road.
Of course.
On site and client visits and things like that. I spend more of my time in the office.
Right.
Or I do more local business. I tend to stay in and around the Ashford area.
Mm-hmm.
So probably once a fortnight we might be in the office together.
Okay.
So then it's...
it's not a problem.
Not a problem.
No, okay. And I was just interested in
not much in time that. To argue over policies and stuff, which is good.
And then when we do get together, then we just talk about where we're going. Where's the business going, and how do we grow, and what do we do next?
So, when you originally started, or when Andrew originally started the business, what was the kind of ethos behind it? What was the kind of the thinking about Invicta Safety? What were you there to kind of do? What were you there to kind of service in the marketplace?
The initial setup was, he comes from a health and safety background. He'd done that in previous jobs, and he'd got made redundant. But a lot of people that he knew, he'd made contacts, was asking for his help. Can you help us write our risk assessments? Can you help us? So he was like, oh, okay, well, I'll set up and do my own business.
Was that 8 years ago? Was that kind of the start of the health and safety kind of...
explosion.
Yeah, I mean, for want of a better word.
People were becoming more aware of... their responsibilities.
You're right. That's a nice way of putting it, yeah. So previously we were just kind of just going about our business without actually being overly aware of risk, for example, in our kind of day-to-day operations and managing that risk.
Yeah, I mean, health and safety has been around since, I think it's something like 1800 and something initially.
Right, okay, that's interesting.
The law at the moment is the Health and Safety Work Act. It's 1974.
Okay.
And that's when things really started being put into place.
Right.
And then it's developed from there on in.
Uh-huh.
And more recently, fines are getting bigger.
Mm.
So bigger companies are more aware of their responsibilities. Mm. And from a lot of our work comes from construction and allied trades. And people can't get into building sites, like small businesses, one-man bands, things like that, unless they've got some form of health and safety. There's lots of pre-qualifying questionnaires or accreditations that they need.
Yeah.
So when you see your vans driving around with their little stickers on the back that says Safe Contractor or CHAS or various different things on there, that's what they need to say they're health and safety compliant and they're following the right process.
So I think it's fair to say that it hasn't got the best... reputation, has it, health and safety, as a sort of a business critical operational kind of area?
No,
often the butt of many jokes, isn't it?
Health and safety gone mad, and that drives us mad. Because a lot of it isn't actually law.
No,
it's just businesses trying to cover themselves and going wrapping everybody up in bubble wrapping.
Is a lot of it kind of guidance, advisory, and
a lot of it is.
They're just scared
that they're going to get sued. That their employees are going to suddenly start having accidents and they're going to cost them a lot of money.
I hate that cliche. There's a cliche, isn't there? Where there's blame, there's a claim.
It's one of the old cliches.
But if you think about it in that respect, if you've been negligent as an employer on some kind of safety level, then, you know, it just follows that clearly you are going to open yourselves up to... I know supermarkets, they are incredibly conscious of slip hazards, for example. You know, if you're near the sort of deli counter or the freezer that's broken down or somebody drops a bottle of wine. I mean, my wife stuck a bottle of wine in the trolley the other day. and she stuck it in the top bit where there's a huge hole, but you know, where the baby seat is, and she just went straight through and smashed on the floor. And somebody came out immediately to tidy it up. And yet, when I was in France last week and walking around one of their enormous hypermarkets around the kind of poissonnière, you know, the fish counter, I mean, I was slipping all over the place, and I'm thinking, crikey, all I need to do is slip up here and, you know, there's a claim. I mean, it's as simple as that, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Like I say, people, they have this fear, or employers have this fear that, you know, they're going to get sued, or they're going to going to cost them money.
Yeah.
Or, again, they won't get the work because they haven't got the health and safety in place.
Right.
So, like you were saying, the financial side of it is quite huge. Mm. And then the moral aspect as well, because...
But you mentioned construction, and which I think is a really interesting one, because, you know, Brian and I both know a builder... and he needs to remain completely nameless.
Bob, we'll call him Bob the Builder.
And Bob's view of the world is, I can't get my guys on site to wear hard hats and, you know, or, you know, do this and wear special boots and all this kind of stuff.
Because, and high-vis jackets.
Yeah, high-vis jackets, another great example, because they're used to doing their job in the way that they've always done it, you know, for the last 25, 30, whatever it is, number of years. And so for him, managing a crew, if you like, on a site is actually an incredibly impossible. Difficult thing to do, because as soon as his back's turned and he's not on every site, you know, every hour of the
day...
They're
whipping their kit off.
Exactly. And then, but should something happen, should a breeze block fall off a scaffolding board, you know, 10 feet up in the air and hit somebody on the head... They're going to be in trouble, aren't they? And he's the one that's ultimately going to pay the price for that, I guess. Mm.
To a certain degree, yeah. The employee still has a legal duty to carry out their work safely.
Right.
So if the employer has provided the PPE and they've signed off on it to say that, yes, we've provided it for you, this is how you use it, and they've shown that they can give all of that to the employer. If he decides then not to wear it...
Mm.
Yes, to a certain degree, it's up to the employer to make sure that they are following, like you say, they're not there all the time, so they can't enforce it.
Mm.
So there is a level there that the employee has to take a certain amount.
Okay. So it's not all...
Sign a contract to say that he will, I guess.
Yeah, and it's not all down to the employer.
A disclaimer.
Right. The employee has their own sort of like legal requirements as well.
Okay.
I mean, it's often different, I think, you've said about France there, and you often go to Spain and places like that, and it's very, very different, isn't it? You know, Spanish builders, Manana, and there's like half a house, and it has been for 20 years, or half a block of apartments. I know there are other reasons for that, but I shouldn't laugh, I know, but I was in Spain a few weeks back, and, somebody spilled a drink and stuff, and like you say, so they bring out one of these yellow cones that says caution wet floor and put it there, and the next person that come along tripped over the sign. I thought it was hilarious. It's huge plastic cone that was 2 foot high, and they tripped over that.
So
and I just thought if I'd have left it, they'd have been perfectly
fine. Amazing, isn't it?
But they've put this bloody sign there and they've fallen over it. But I mean, is it something that... Have you noticed that legislation has changed quite a lot over the last kind of 5 years? Is it legislation that's changed, or is it people's awareness of that legislation because of the monetary and moral responsibilities?
Yes, more the awareness. The legislation has rarely changes.
Right.
There was a report come out last week, and it said that in Britain, we're one of the highest levels of health and safety legislation in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of the leaders.
Well, anyway, it's not really changed.
So
it's just
not changed. Okay. It's just people are more aware of it now. Mm. And, there's more... There's, like I say, some of the bigger companies are getting bigger fines, and so then it's having that awareness.
Mm.
And, like I say, the smaller guys, they need to have that extra awareness,
mm.
which is why they come to us, because we can provide that for them.
Mm.
They don't have the time to do it themselves. They don't. They're not necessarily competent.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big phrase in health and safety. You just have to be competent.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can provide all of that information and all that support
mm-hmm.
so that they can get on with doing what they've done.
Got you.
And one of the biggest things we get is people say, well, I've been doing this job, like you say, for 20 years and I've never had an accident.
Mm.
Well, that's probably more luck than anything else.
Yeah. Your luck's going to run out.
Just because you've been doing it doesn't mean to say it's the safest way, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to have an accident.
Yeah. But you can also help people. I mean, a very interesting kind of asset that I think you have in your business is your whole online training program that you can offer to clients as well. So you don't necessarily have to be on-site training people in a room. No. People can self-train themselves through online programs like you offer. So how does that work exactly?
Well, we have, I think we've just gone up to about 37 different courses.
Mm-hmm.
Ranging from health and safety, and then we have health, because there's you've got the safety side and then you've got the health side.
Mm-hmm.
So then there's a lot of social care and a lot around schools as well, and safeguarding and things along those lines. With the online training, you get access to the online training suite. You tell us what you want to buy. We'll set up the courses for you. So if you're a business, for example, we would set you up a business account.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd nominate one person, and then you say, I want the licenses for this amount of courses. We give you those, mm-hmm. and then you go on and share them amongst your workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And each course is modular. So anything from, I think one of them has only got about 4 or 5 modules, and then others have got sort of like 8, 9, or 10. So as long as you've completed one module, you can then stop, go off and do your work, mm-hmm. come back and do it. So you don't have to sit all day in a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to take all your workforce out and hire a room and go and have training, mm-hmm. and things like that. You can do it to suit your business.
Right.
I've got a client actually today who's going to do one of our courses, and she's on the train. She said,
right.
I'm traveling for a couple of hours,
yes.
so I'm going to sit on the train and do mm-hmm. it on mm-hmm. the train.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that versatile.
Good use of downtime.
And, yeah. and does it go in, though? I mean, when people do those kind of online modular courses, does the information actually sink in? Do you have to have learnt it properly for it to then be able to pass it?
There's questions at the end of each mm-hmm. module, and
right.
Sometimes everyone gets 3 attempts at each module, mm. and we monitor that, because it comes to us and says, oh, they've had 3 attempts, so we have to reset them another go. And most people do get it first time.
Mm-hmm.
There's one or two that you kind of get them coming through. And you can't go to the next stage until you've done the
right.
one before,
okay.
and then you don't get your certificate if you haven't got the required pass mark.
Mm.
And some of them are hard enough that you have to get 100%.
Right.
So you have to keep going back and rereading and redoing.
It's like an online obstacle course, isn't it?
Well,
you can't pass the next bit until you've done your first bit.
But
go
in
back
today's
and do it again.
Day and age, it just kind of makes perfect sense, doesn't it, to kind of do it that way?
It does.
You can get it on your mobile phone, your tablets.
At a time to suit you, actually.
Yeah, suits
and if you want to do it at home in your time rather than doing it in the office, then you can do it that way as well, I guess, can't you?
Absolutely, yeah.
Good.
I think it's part of positive change, isn't it? Because certainly I've been a lot more aware of health and safety over the last 2, 3, 4 years than I ever was before. I don't know why. Mm. It just seems to have come to the fore and be a lot more acceptable as well. I think people have accepted that it's part and parcel, and we can't
get
crack
some
on.
Of the big news stories, well, like Grenfell Tower,
yes.
for example, that really made.
Yeah.
And they've now, this week, just starting on the actual revision of the fire regulations and things like
yes.
that.
Mm-hmm.
There's good stuff coming out of it. Mm. The reports are now coming out, and they're saying, you know, this is what needs to be done, and this is
where
we need to go. And
sad that though it is that something like that has to happen before the law
often
changes.
The way,
it is often the way, isn't
you
it?
Get some of your big disasters, you know, your Piper Alphas and
yes,
things
oh
like
gosh,
that. Big
yes,
things like
horrible.
That happen, and then everybody kind of starts into action and go,
health and safety. But I want to talk about something else you offer, which is it SSIP accreditation?
We offer support to people that need to get so an SSIP is a safe system in procurement.
Right.
And it is a body of, it's like an umbrella of other sort of companies that they offer.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, your Safe Contractor, CHAS, Construction Line. So they're almost for the building trade. Although
right.
I have put clients through it that are not necessarily builders as such, but they are sort of contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of companies now, your big players, so like your Taylor Wimpey's and people like that, they're asking for small contractors to have this accreditation.
Right. So that's the key thing. So it's a really important part of the procurement process.
Yeah.
If you want to tender, you know, as a subbie on a site to do whatever job, you're going to need to have some form of accreditation.
Yeah. And they, what those accreditations do, they ask for what is your health and safety policy, and you have to upload all the documents. So it can be quite a painful process.
Yes, I bet.
If you're, like you say, you've
not
been
used
doing
to
it
doing
for years
it.
And you haven't got a lot of stuff in place, and so I'm constantly asking my clients, say, can you do this? Can I have that? Got it. So they're looking for health and safety policy, they're looking for training, and not just one-off training. Every year, if you go for it and everything lasts a year, so the next year they'll say, what training have you done this year?
Right.
So it's ongoing training all the time. What risk assessments have you got? What jobs have you done in the past? And give us examples of so it's the first year is, I wouldn't say it's easier to get through, but it's a lot less painful because you're working from scratch, and then we can come in right from the beginning and say, right, we'll talk you through it. This is what you need to do. We'll hold your hand. We'll get you through. The second year, we're saying, right, what have you done this year? Continue that training. Continue that learning, and making
to
sure that your
further
staff
improve
are,
things.
Yeah, making sure that your staff are constantly being trained up and reminded of things. Anything from a simple toolbox talk and right through to sort of some form of health and safety training. So the bigger your business, even if you've only got, say, 20, 30 people, it might be worth just having one person to do a basic health and safety course. You know, not necessarily get a full-on qualification, but have some form of basic training there so that it shows that you've got that seriousness. I've got people that are, you know, they've lost jobs because they haven't had this, or they've taken so long to get through the process because they're like, oh, we're busy. And then it's like, oh, we've lost the job. You're like, yeah, well, sometimes, you know, you've got to bite the bullet sometimes and go through the pain barrier. And then come out the other side and win all the jobs and make more money.
And then your other bread and butter, I guess, the kind of, I mean, we're not going to talk about fire today, I know, because that's very much Andrew's specialism. But your kind of day to day bread and butter is actually risk assessments, I guess, and helping people kind of go through that whole process. What is a risk assessment? You know, why do we need to do it? And what does it look like? And you can help them with templates and things like that for them to manage that within their own business,
and
I guess.
To a certain degree, we can write a lot for them. I think in the package that we do, when we offer the full support package, we offer, I think it's up to 10 risk-based or task-based risk assessments. So if you're local, I will come to your property and have a look. What do you do? Because the easiest way to write a risk assessment is to actually go there and see what the risks are.
How the job is done,
job
I
is
guess.
Done. Yeah, and what do you do? Speak to the staff, because they're the ones that know how to do the job. And then from that, I can go away and say, right, this is the risk that I can see. You've got your common ones, your slips, trips and falls, your manual handling.
Slips, trips and falls. I like that. Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Sounds like a firm of solicitors.
Yes.
Or as one of the pictures I put up on Facebook today, I found one. It was lost in translation, and it was a Japanese or Chinese underneath, and it said slip carefully.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you've got the generic ones, but then you've also got your specifics dependent on what the job is. So
and you can just help people save so much time and effort in that whole area, because you can see it immediately, can't you? As soon as you walk into a business, it's that, you know, and that's all you need.
Yeah, I mean, I walk into anywhere and you can't help my eyes with that. I'm looking at the ceiling because you're looking for smoke detectors, you're looking for fire exit signs, you're looking at fire extinguishers and things like that. And so, yeah, we're constantly looking at different things as we walk about.
Wow. So quite an important kind of extension of your business, I would suggest, if you're not currently engaged in actively managing health and safety in the workplace. So,
it's become an essential, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Kim, how do people get in touch with you if we need to kind of come to you for some expert advice? What's the best way to do that?
The best way is through the website, through the contact us. On the website, it gives you the online training as well and the all of the different services that we offer.
So that's Invicta Safety.
www.invictasafety.co.uk.
Right.
So nice and simple. Uh-huh. And then that email will come through to myself and Andrew, and then one of us will contact you back, and then we'll sit and have a chat with you.
Perfect.
Work out what it is you actually
and it's
need.
Got details of your online training courses, I think, as well, hasn't it? And everything that you
there.
Do. Perfect. And I know you've recently discovered Twitter.
I have.
So you're at Safety Invicta, I think, isn't it, on the Twitter? So we can follow you there as well.
And I have LinkedIn. We have a LinkedIn page.
Yes.
And Facebook as well.
Yes. So and I love your posts. You're always putting up posts that kind of make people think about
people tripping over.
Oh, I'm doing that. Yeah.
My Facebook posts tend to be a bit more of the humorous side of health and safety.
Yeah.
And then the LinkedIn side is more of the legislation and, and what fines have been given out and what you can learn from that and what you need to have in place. So.
Brilliant. Well, for now, Kim, thank you so much again for coming on the show. It's been very enlightening, I think, Brian, for certainly for you and I, but more importantly, people we know outside of this room who who we need to have a conversation, a very serious conversation with. So
can he fix it?
Yeah. Well, hopefully it's not too late. So, Kim, thank you so much. And, yeah, we look forward to welcoming you again to the studio at some point in the near future. But for now, thank you. Brian, I know you've got a couple of items, quick items that you want to talk about. I think we've got 3 or 4 minutes left. So what have you got?
Yeah, there's dozens and dozens of events that we could run through.
But we haven't got time.
Because time is against us. So we'll just pick out 3 or 4, shall we say, ones that are close to home. So tomorrow, actually, which is Tuesday the 17th, I'll be running my first Dartford Business Club, DBC, which is takes place at Dartford Football Ground from 11:45 to 2:15. So, and that's a business club with a difference. So if people want to kind of talk to me about that going forward, I'd be more than happy to. Wednesday the 18th, Martin, I believe you've got something.
Oh, yes, we've got our after hours. Kim, I know you come to that. So we've got our monthly after hours at 6 o'clock at the Ashford International Hotel. So it's just a free-to-attend networking with refreshments. So we look forward to seeing you there.
Excellent. And I would love to come, but I can't because I'm Kent Spacing at the other end of the county. So I'll be with Sue and Shannon and Hayley.
Maybe not Kent Sue, because I think she might be in Turkey at the moment.
Is she not back? Mm-hmm. She should be back today or tomorrow, okay. I reckon. If she's having an extended holiday, she hasn't sent me a note or anything, so I want to see. So, if Sue isn't there, then we'll just crack on without her. But that's Kent Space Ashford. 5:30 to 7:30, also on Wednesday the 18th.
And the brilliant Vicky, who manages the site here in Ashford, where we're broadcasting from, is also hosting the Ashford Kent Space monthly networking.
On Wednesday?
A week on Wednesday.
Oh, okay.
So a week this Wednesday, you can also come here at 5:30. And Kim, I know you come to that as well. Yeah. So is there any way you don't go? As long as it's around Ashford, I guess. You're always there, aren't you?
Good. So that'll be the 25th, won't
it?
Yes. Okay, all right. I'll be at Metrobank FSB Maidstone from 6 to 7:30.
Oh, okay.
So there's an inadvertent shout-out for yet another event.
Another event
I didn't
that's
even
happening.
Have written down, so that's a Brucey bonus.
I think
there.
It's fair to say that after the summer holidays, we are well and truly back in the swing of networking.
Once
all
you get
networking.
Into September or second half of September and on. And finally from me, and this is the big one. This is the one they've all been waiting for. Wednesday the 25th, which is Wednesday week, is the launch of my third group, which is BBN Medway, which takes place at Buckmore Park. So every 2 weeks from Wednesday the 25th, like Dartford and Maidstone, capped to 54 businesses, and I actually have 49 businesses booked in for that. So there's 4 or 5 spaces left, and there's a couple of industries. Look at my LinkedIn post, but a couple of industries I'd be particularly interested in talking to.
Good. Well, we wish you good luck with that, Brian.
Thanks, mate.
And hope that all goes well. But I think we've come to the end of our show, believe it or not. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with some more fabulous guests and some very topical Kent business news. But for now, thank you so much, everybody, for coming on the show. You've been absolutely superb. And we look forward to catching up with you in 2 weeks' time.
We certainly do.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.